This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
It can feel at times like there's no movie that can't be made into a Broadway musical, and no such Broadway musical that can't be made back into a movie. The latest project to get this treatment is Mean Girls, a film adaptation of the Broadway adaptation of the beloved Lindsay Lohan comedy.
The songs are there, the dances are there, and the nasty, nasty high school drama is there, but does this retelling capture the energy, the style, and the jokes of the original? I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about Mean Girls, and we are making Fetch happen on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me and Glenn today is Weilin Wong. She's the co-host of NPR's daily economics podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. Welcome back, Weilin.
Thank you. Former mathlete reporting for duty.
Oh, wow. Fabulous. Me too. Oh, also with us is Andrew Limbong. He's the host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast and a reporter for the Culture Desk. Always great to have you, Andrew.
Yo, what's up? What's up?
Well, Mean Girls tells the story of Katie, played here by Anne Gowrie Rice, who starts her very first year at an American high school after being homeschooled in Africa by her mother. She falls in with a couple of offbeat outcasts, Janice, played by Ali E. Carvalho, and Damien, played by Jacquel Spivey. But before long, she also meets the Plastics, the mean girl clique presided over by Regina George, played here by Renee Rapp. The songs in the film, like the ones in the show, have music by Jeff Richmond, who's the husband and longtime collaborator of Tina Fey, and lyrics by Nell Benjamin, though a bunch of songs were cut and one was added. And Fey wrote the screenplay here as she did for the original film. Mean Girls is in theaters now. Weilin, I want to start with you. What did you think?
I liked it. It was a lot of fun. I really love the original, and so I do go in with that kind of looming large in my cultural imagination, in my inner life. Like, I think this movie means a lot, has like really shaped my inner life in a lot of ways. And I was looking for this version to kind of deliver another layer of meaning, make me think about the themes in a different way, or I wanted the musical element of it to really enhance the story and kind of open up my understanding in a new way that way. And I don't think it totally got there for me, but I did have a lot of fun. I will say I wanted more set pieces, more musical set pieces. I think they cut some of the songs from the musical.
A lot.
They cut. Yeah.
And I could have used all those songs back in the movie. Like, if they were going to make a movie musical, I wanted full movie musical. You know, like, the movie ends at a school dance, and I wanted a huge choreographed number at the end, like at the end of She's All That. Like, that's what I was looking for. Yeah. And they end up, I think, being, like, kind of restrained in how much music they integrate. So I kind of wanted it to go bigger. But I did enjoy the music they did have in there. I loved seeing Tina Fey and Tim Meadows come back, and I like cackled throughout at a lot of the writing. Some of the lines obviously repeated from the original, but still hilarious. And then some of the new writing too. I thought it was really funny. I had a lot of fun.
Did you feel like you needed that choreographed number at the end to be Rockefeller Skank, or could it have been something else?
I like Rockefeller Skank. I think I just wanted like the whole gym singing and dancing in a much more kind of movie music. This is a movie musical kind of a way.
Or you were looking for like the Thriller dance in 13 Going on 30. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Andrew, I saw you at this screening. I know you were there. Uh-huh. What did you think?
Uh-huh. You know, didn't need it, but I'm glad it exists. I liked watching it. I agree 100% with Weilin. I think the pacing is wonky. I did want more like High School Musical. I did want like kids doing flips and like crazy stuff happening, some more like dancey set piecey things. But other than that, I think there is a weight of it. It has the albatross of the original hanging over its neck in a not super good way, you know, and it doesn't deal with it. I think there's a lot of the memorable lines that we all like know and love from the original Mean Girls. They get delivered in a way in this movie in a very knowing fashion. It's like circled. We know that you know this line, and so we're telling you that we know. And it really kind of beleaguers the movie a bit. And Linda, our screening was packed with like Mean Girls fans, and I don't remember any of these lines you know, and I'm talking about like making fetch happen or like ex-boyfriends are off limits. That's the rules of feminism. Like those kind of lines we all know. Mm-hmm. I don't remember like them getting any big laughs from like the full on stands that were at our screening, right? Mm.
I think there were a couple that maybe did, but I agree with you that the reaction was a little bit muted to those things. And one of the things I thought about is that, you know, it feels to me like a fan project. And I don't say that like as a dig. Many fan projects are wonderful, but I don't know how much sense this movie would make outside the context of having watched and being a fan of the original movie. I think the story wouldn't necessarily hang together terribly well, and I think thematically I'm not sure it would. It feels like a tribute to the original movie in a way that's kind of, I think, exactly what you're talking about. Those kind of familiar lines are really underlined. Glenn, what did you think?
Well, I really dug this, which surprised me because I came into this movie with a kind of a chip on my shoulder. I'm coming at this movie from a much different place than you two, Waylon and Andrew, because I come from a much older place. I saw the original movie in theaters. I came out of it thinking, this is fine, but it's not Heathers. And the 1988 film Heathers is a high school dark comedy that's actually dark, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also not for nothing, for whatever reason. It's the high school film that I imprinted on. It became part of my personality, still is, still cling to it. And between that and Buffy, I have often felt that everything needs to be said about high school has been said. Mm-hmm. But when I was a good gay uncle and I did my civic duty and I took my niece and sister-in-law to the musical Mean Girls on Broadway, I came out of it thinking that was fine, but it's still not Heathers and it has no memorable songs. I mean, they were generic musical theater songs, but they felt so Broadway that it was like watching like a Broadway pastiche, the kind that you'd see on 30 Rock, say. Or like, you know, when people say, well, it's improv a musical, and then they do the same three chord progressions, and you're like, oh, they kind of nailed it, actually. So why did I like this so much better? Well, the stage production was 2.5 hours with intermission. This was a little over an hour and a half. Am I that simple and basic and predictable? Yes, yes, and yes, turns out.
Nothing wrong with that.
I mean,
dude.
Look. Yeah. I also think it works because we cut some of those really forgettable songs, and we worked the others that had potential on Broadway that I don't think the production tapped into. So every song gets a pop makeover instead of a Broadway jazz handy thing. And that gives the songs an energy that I think was lacking on Broadway. Now, you could argue they're pretty generic pop songs, the way that the stage production had pretty generic Broadway tunes, but they just work better. And they did other smart things. They got rid of Katie's dad, who didn't add anything. They gave Katie a new and I think much better opening I Want song. Because in that opening one song in the Broadway show, which I think was called It Roars, she came off as kind of a jerk. And here, in the song called What Ifs, she's just nicer. And so we get a better arc for her. Like she's got more places to go. I just thought the reimagining of the show really worked really well.
Yeah, I preferred the songs in this that were the more Broadway-like songs, some of which remind me a lot specifically of Jason Robert Brown, who wrote The Last 5 Years and some other things. The songs that are a little more lyrically dense, the songs that have kind of playful lyrics, I enjoyed a lot. Her little song about falling in love in math class I thought was cute. That I Want song at the beginning I think is cute. Not as much the big, like super serious, we're taking on a major pop song. And that comes out specifically, I think, and this was kind of my biggest struggle, I think, with this film, is the way that they imagine Regina George in this movie is very different from the Regina George that I know from the original movie, which is fine. It's not as if, you know, whoever did this doesn't understand the original movie, right? These are all choices. But the choice here is to present Regina much more, I mean, to me, she's going full like
Disney.
She's going full like lead in a 90s erotic thriller where she's going to murder people. It's really heavy. Like there's a lot more like black leather and sort of it doesn't to me capture quite the insidious nature of those relationships the way that my initial sense of Regina George did. This Regina is never being nice to your face. She's always just being a huge, terrifying bully all the time. And to me, it took away a little bit from, you know, in the original movie, Katie talks about how the more she sort of is mean to Gretchen and Karen, the more they want to please her. And I don't think you get that here. They go pretty quickly into the poor Gretchen and poor Karen Like, that's all hit very hard, including like a whole song at the beginning that's just Gretchen talking about how sad she is, which I think I like it better when that arises a little more slowly. So I respect what everybody did here. I think a couple of the songs are really fun little like poppy type things, although they do remind me a lot of other Broadway. But I don't, this vision of Regina George, despite how talented Renee Rapp is, and let me underline that part, it just was not my favorite way to envision this character.
My name is Regina George, and I am a massive deal. I will grind you to sand beneath my lieutenant.
I think she could kill me, you know, like she will murder me with a knife, and quite literally. And I enjoy that change of dynamic. But in the sort of third act, when Katie gets the upper hand, that's where the math of who's on top and who's scary and who's intimidating doesn't quite like line up. Right. Because this version of Katie does the innocent part really well, but her like mean streak is more indifferent than having like a sort of sense of agency and choosing to be mean. And yeah. So then we're stuck with like, you know, in a very, someone's still on the upper ground and it's still Regina by the third act, if that makes sense.
I thought, you know, Rachel McAdams was believably mean, but Renee Rapp is a Disney villain. She's big. She is completely fitting. I think that's the form. The form is, this is a musical. Emotions are heightened. You have to play to the back of the house, even if that house is a movie house. I thought it fit. And I thought you have to make different connections and do different work. I particularly want to shout out Avantika, who plays Karen, the dumb one, because playing the dumb one is on the surface very easy to do, but it's very difficult to do without leaning into stuff that everyone who's ever played a dumb character has done. I thought she located something very specific and very funny. And in the song Sexy, which is the song about Halloween costumes, she's just having such a great time. And that song is a banger.
And that set piece hit like right when I was like looking at my watch. Like, we need a big number right about now. Yeah.
I wanted to shout out Ali Cravacho and Jacal Spivey. I loved them as Janice and Damien. And Ali Cravacho in particular, I thought really brought something to this. I really enjoyed watching her. She opens the whole movie with a very strong kind of almost like Greek chorus type number. And I really, really enjoyed watching her. And I don't think I'd seen her anything since like Moana. So I was like, oh, hey, it's Moana as Janice Ian. I loved it.
Yeah. And I think Jacal Spivey, too. Damien is such, to me, a beloved take on the sort of what can be a very stereotypical gay best friend, right? And I think what I love about this is that there's more than one way to be a broad characterization of a gay best friend. And I think this is one that also works, even though it's in a lot of ways quite different. And I think sells the heck out of it. You know, I enjoyed that part a lot.
I want to say Tim Meadows doing hero's work. I did some research. I watched the unknown movie Mean Girls 2, the director of Freeform.
Oh boy, that's over and above the Call of Duty.
Really?
He holds it together.
He's like, in that? He's in Mean Girls 2? Oh my gosh.
He's the only good part of that movie. But I was like, wow, this man is really committed to this character. And I gotta really respect that.
Can I ask you about something that struck me? And this is probably in the original movie. I don't recall. I only saw it once. But there's an assembly where the Tina Fey character talks to the girls about how girls are mean to girls. And they get a stern talking to when there's trust exercises. And I understand that's everything what this movie is. It's called Mean Girls. It just felt like that was kind of a circular firing squad. Right. And like there's 50% of the population of this high school that are being mean to. Right. And I just felt, I don't know, that's one of those things that the connective tissue that didn't connect for me. But I you know, that's the whole point of the film. Right.
I think the farther you get down that road to like everything, as you mentioned, Glenn, getting bigger and more literally theatrical, the harder it is to then make that turn and try to have a semi-serious conversation. I think the bigger of the rest of it makes that turn a little harder than it is in the original film.
I think another kind of tough thing about landing that scene and really selling it is that, you know, since this is a modern film, they layer in the social media aspect to it and the smartphone aspect of it, which is obviously absent in the original because of the time in which it came out. And I don't think this movie does anything to reckon with the harm that would be amplified by social media in those same situations. I mean, I appreciated that they still kept a paper analog burn book, but they layer all this social media stuff on top where you see that kids are posting like on their TikTok accounts about what's happening in school. And, you know, not to make this into like a realistic docudrama about, you know, a school actually falling apart over bullying, but they lean into the kind of fun aspects of social media to do these montages, which I did think were really well done. But they don't talk about what that would do to, again, magnify the harm caused by these in-person interactions. And I feel like there was an opportunity in that assembly scene to maybe deal with some of that. And then that would make this film feel more present, more kind of addressing modern day dynamics. And instead, they just kind of do a recreation of what happens in the original, which was already kind of an after-school special way to deal, I think, with a lot of these issues. But then again, if you are going big and this is the Broadwayization or whatever of this story, then you don't really have any choice but to do kind of like a big assembly with like every cast member on stage.
Yeah, I think that's right. When you get into these conversations, it's easy to feel, as I do right now, like you want to say, look, I do get that it's supposed to be fun and big and funny and broad. And it's not, as you said, a docudrama. But I think there is an effort to have it both ways at least a little bit and to be saying something at least a little bit actually resonant about what school is like for a certain percentage of kids. But listen, shout out to the mathletes. As someone who went to a national math competition only because my school was in Delaware, you know, I appreciate the love of math. As I said, everybody in this is really talented. I think Anne Gowrie Rice, who is taking over such a famous part here, as the people who played this role on Broadway did, does an absolutely fine job. It was an up and down experience for me. I enjoyed parts of it, but I was a little meh on the final product.
I don't know if you guys noticed the weird amount of product placement. Well, it felt weird to me. It actually took me out of the movie at certain points. There was like a point where Katie is using a compact and she's applying some kind of lip product and you see the logo for the cosmetics company prominently on the compact. And then someone says, what product is that? And she says, it's the e.l.f. lip blah, 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 which is probably a product I can buy right now.
I did notice the e.l.f. thing now that you mention it.
And then at the math competition, they say, oh, this math competition is sponsored by SeatGeek. And then the Kevin character shouts out, yeah, SeatGeek. And I was like, am I watching an infomercial? It was very funny to me. And I'm like, are the economics of this movie? You know, why was it? Were they contractually obligated not only to display a logo, but to actually say the name of the company, too? And then something nice about it is very odd to me.
I did think the SeatGeek thing was a joke because it seemed like something Kevin, as a, I assume, a guy who listens to podcasts, you know, like that brand of podcast would definitely use.
It does seem clear that there was some. The SeatGeek thing went right by me because I just thought that sounded like some random sponsor of a mathlete competition.
Yeah.
So. Well, I think that we all enjoyed this movie to some degree, and we want to know what you think about Mean Girls. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Up next, what's making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. This message comes from NPR sponsor Mattress Firm. To feel energized this spring, you need quality sleep. To achieve quality sleep, you need the right mattress. Mattress Firm will help you find the right bed to improve your sleep with their wide selection of quality mattresses at every price. Plus, if you see a lower price, Mattress Firm will match it. The right mattress matters, and Mattress Firm will find yours during the Friends and Family Sale. Shop in-store or online at mattressfirm.com. Restrictions apply. This message comes from NPR sponsor CarMax. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because CarMax believes you shouldn't just settle for a car, you should love your car. That's why every car they sell has CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. Don't settle. Find love at first drive. Start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot, so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
Now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. Waylon, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I recently saw the movie Maestro, and then that sent me down a rabbit hole of looking up old Leonard Bernstein videos on YouTube, because he did all this television, right? At the height of his career, he was doing all these television specials. And so what I've really enjoyed is Bernstein's Young People's Concerts, which these were concerts that aired mostly in the 60s. He did them for years and years. I think over a decade, and they're all on YouTube, and they're fabulous. I mean, he has such a great way of talking about classical music in an accessible way. He's super telegenic, and I really enjoyed, he did one on Holst's Planets, and he does another one that's an introduction to Mahler. And so, I don't know, I just feel like a young Lydia Tarr watching my Bernstein videos. And, you know, the movie Maestro, you know, it's like about his marriage, but you don't get actually like a lot of him like conducting and actually doing music, right? They kind of keep that to a minimum because they focus on the relationship. So then I found myself kind of missing that from Maestro. So then I went to YouTube to just watch Leonard Bernstein being Leonard Bernstein. And I've been having a great time.
That is awesome. Leonard Bernstein, Young People's Concerts, available on YouTube. Thank you, Waylon. Andrew Limbong, what is making you happy this week?
So I've been watching this YouTube channel called What Makes This Song Stink. It's by this guy named Pat Finnerty. I think from my research, he's just like a musician based out of Philly. And what he does is he makes these little essays that turn into something much bigger, right? They're nominally breaking down songwritings of songs that stink. Some previous entries are like Danny California, right? or like a train song, or like Three Doors Down, Kryptonite, which, you know, I think is a great song, but you know, that's neither here nor there. What I like about this channel is that it's not just unadulterated hater energy. It's oddly quite positive about music and songs, and all of the essays turn into just like things about something else, right? Like this most recent episode, which is about the Jason Aldean song, Try That in a Small Town, which does sound like an easy target, but I think he breaks it down in such a way that you learn something new. And I think there's like this clip, there's one moment where he takes the lyrics of the song and puts it to Ohio, you know, an old classic standard, that I think is an example of the quirky way in which he's like not just tearing down and dumping on these songs, but pointing a greater point out.
Try that in a small town. See how far you make it down the road.
Yeah, and I think it's just an extremely funny way to spend, I think it's about an hour, but like it's a good hour. It's a solid hour.
So that's What Makes This Song Stink, which you can find on YouTube. Thank you, Andrew. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Season 5 of Fargo just wrapped on FX and Hulu. This is creator Noah Hawley's anthology series. It's a black comedy. It's a crime drama. It's inspired by the Coen Brothers' 1996 film. And every season has kind of, you know, referenced that film in different ways. But this season goes further. It is a series of very intentional riffs that engage and play with the film without relying on it. It's really satisfying. The cast is stacked, including Juno Temple, who, if you know her from Ted Lasso, where she played Keeley, and you start the season to hear her do that Minnesota accent, and you think, oh, she's going so broad, she's play acting, but damn, if she does not dig in and really show you layers to that performance. The final episode of the season, there is a series of scenes between her and a character played by Sam Spruill, and their work together manages to sneak up to the theme of the original movie, which, you know, has to do with how awful human beings can be to each other and how cruel and violent and hateful, but also that basic human decency has a power that can overcome all that. And I do think the series is actually putting it forward sincerely. I'm in the tank for Noah Hawley. I was loving this season, and then Jennifer Jason Leigh shows up in a blunt cup bob talking like William F. Buckley, and I just rolled over and
yep.
I rolled over for a belly rub is what I did. That is Fargo Season 5 on FX and Hulu.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn. What is making me happy this week is that I've been spending a lot of time with my new PS5. And one of the games that I've been playing is called Two Point Campus. It is a sim game from a company that also made a game called Two Point Hospital that I liked. Two Point Campus, your task is to build what's ultimately a series of college campuses and make them successful and highly regarded and, you know, full of happy students and fulfilled staff. You hire the professors, you hire the assistants and the janitors. Make sure you hire enough janitors or the place gets really messy. And it all sounds really dry, but they style it in a very cartoony style. So although you are genuinely trying to solve all these interlocking problems that are sort of like a big puzzle, which is one of the things I like about this kind of game, it's also there's this underlying silliness to it because, you know, for instance, your training room for your staff has you put them into a big machine that looks like a brain. And if there's an on-campus party, if you zoom in, the students are doing like very funny dance moves. It's all very amusingly animated. I so admire the wit that went into the presentation of it because I had also finally played my way through The Last of Us, which is not a whimsical, fun, upbeat game. So I turned to this very silly cartoon campus sim, and it has been extremely joyful and fun, and it is making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. Waylon Wong, Andrew Limbong, Glenn Weldon, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You can all always sit with us. This episode was produced by Liz Metzger, Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, and it was edited by Jessica Reedy and Mike Katzeff. Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all next week.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
With NPR Plus, you get bonus content from behind the scenes of your favorite shows, like the NPR Politics podcast.
A friend of mine who worked at the Associated Press came in to the courtroom and said, "Step to it. Michael Cohen is flipped on Trump."
And with NPR Plus, you'll be supporting public media. Learn more at plus.npr.org.